When it comes to governing, everyone has an opinion. It was Thomas Jefferson, after all, who said, "I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves." Then on the other hand, it was John Stuart who said, "You have to remember one thing about the will of the people. It wasn't that long ago that we were swept away by the Macarena." It was Leo Tolstoy who once said, "Writing laws is easy, but governing is difficult." Welcome to Steps to Value, a podcast that explores the intersection of people, processes, and technology in healthcare as the industry moves towards a value-focused model. I'm your host, Rod Pihowski, and in today's episode, we'll explore the impact that governmental policy has on the health information technology industry with Dr. Karen DeSalvo, Acting Assistant Secretary and the former National Coordinator for Health Information Technology in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We'll also get an update from HIMSS Vice President Pat Wise on HIMSS Pathways to Value. Now, that's a collection of action plans focused on key areas with high potential for health IT value realization. And it includes clinical decision support, remote monitoring, clinical business analytics, information exchange for care coordination, and patient safety. All that and more coming up. I'm here with Pat Wise. Pat is Vice President, Health Information Systems for HIMSS, and she's here to share an initiative she's been working on. Pat, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rod.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about this initiative and what's its goal and who are we targeting and the high-level story on this?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to draw our listeners' attention to the HIMSS Value Suite. This particular suite is a resource that's available on the HIMSS website, and I want to draw particular attention to the Pathways to Value. Pathways to Value was conceived last year, but actually its history goes back much further. As part of the Davies Award, organizations applying for the Davies submit up to 5 case studies, indicating and showing and giving us the how-to. How did they get value from their HIT? And over the years, as more and more organizations applied, we received more and more case studies, we started seeing similarities. We started seeing patterns, for instance, in patient safety. As organizations had a strategic goal for patient safety, they started following similar steps. This wasn't done in consultation with each other. This was done as organizations realized that we need to do step A, and then we need to take a look at B, and then we need to maybe take a look at C. And we started finding these patterns in organizations who clearly have achieved, clearly have derived outcomes through their HIT. And that gave birth to the Pathways to Value, which can be found on the HIMSS Value Suite. The Pathways to Value are organized in a variety of different areas, and they literally represent the patterns that we have seen in organizations as they work with clinical decision support, as they work with patient safety, as they work in a number of different areas. And it, as it's called, Pathways to Value, this are kind of the steps that organizations have followed as they've moved forward with their strategic initiatives, be it a wide-ranging implementation in clinical decision support or something in patient safety. This is the Pathways to Value, and wanted to bring that to your attention today.
Great. So is there a timeline or anything affiliated with this? It's already out there, right?
It's already out there. It's available on the HIMSS website, www.hims.org. It's the Value Suite. And I urge everyone to take a look at that and see how your organization, what steps are similar that your organization might have taken to the Pathways to Value that are listed there.
Well, great, Pat. We'll send people to that website when we post this, this episode. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The annual National Health IT Week is being held September 26th through the 30th, 2016. Join us for this collaborative forum where public and private healthcare constituents work in partnership to educate industry and policy stakeholders on the value of health IT for the U.S. healthcare system. Initiated in 2006, National Health IT Week has emerged as a landmark occasion for using health IT as part of the overall solution to improve America's healthcare as a bipartisan, federally led, market-driven initiative. The week consists of events across the country, including National Health IT Week participants, vendors, provider organizations, payers, pharmaceutical biotech companies, government agencies, industry and professional associations, research foundations, and consumer protection groups, all working together to elevate national attention to the advantages of advancing health IT. Make sure your voice is heard. Learn how to participate in National Health IT Week at healthitweek.org. I'm here with Dr. Karen DeSalvo, the Acting Assistant Secretary for Health and the former National Coordinator for Health Information Technology in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Karen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, Rod, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of different things today, but because you're on the policy side, we wanted to ask a question about where, in your experience, have you seen HIT policy proving to be the most effective?
Well, you know, the approach that we have been taking at HHS on health IT policy is one that has been collaborative with the private sector and is sort of embedded in the name of the national coordinator, that we have a responsibility not only to coordinate across the federal partners, but with the private sector. There's a lot of dynamism and innovation in the marketplace that we want to make sure that we embrace and leave room for as people are planning a long-term journey ahead, and we see our responsibility in the federal government is creating the right policy and protective framework for individuals and their data in particular. So I think it's most effective then when the federal partners and the private sector, and I would include the states in that, have an agreement on the vision and the way forward, and that gives the market a sense of stability and a sense that this is going to be the work plan and the roadmap for the next number of years, and lets people work towards those goals together.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned long-term journey and innovation in kind of the same answer. Are there any areas that you think we're going to see some really interesting innovation in over the coming years?
Well, I really hope that there's continued innovation in a space of creating a longitudinal health record for individuals, so meaning a better, smarter version of the personal health record that we tried in the past, but one that is populated in an automated fashion from all of your visits or encounters with healthcare, and then can layer in your other health information, whether it's from your, you know, your health tracker, your steps tracker, or some sort of a food tracker, or even increasingly using geocoding to look at environmental exposures. So I guess I certainly have heard so much from people that they want to have a long-term health record that is inclusive of data points that's more than just that one healthcare system. And I certainly know that from a policy standpoint and a public health standpoint, that then also creates an opportunity to blend that data with consent or anonymized to paint a picture of communities in a longer-term fashion than trying to piecemeal together from the healthcare system. And that all that requires us to get on the same set of standards, and, you know, we've really been pushing for that at HHS, particularly in the last couple of years, because innovation is great, but you have to have some floor of standards. And then, of course, we've really pushed to open that doorway to the data to see that people publish their APIs so that it's much easier for the data to be collected and assembled on behalf of the consumer.
And when we talk about patient engagement, that's really the bottom line. That's the foundation for really getting them engaged, is when they can start to add in information about themselves. It's totally personalized. That seems to be key.
Yeah, I have. I had the experience just yesterday with one of my staff who went to a new practice that uses a pretty sophisticated electronic health record, and the staff person pulled up the app and you know, flashed it to me and said, "Look, my immunization records already in my record on my app on my smartphone," and that just sort of light in the eyes of a person. There's so many stories we can recount of ourselves or our own patients or of people that we work with who get excited when they can have access to that data in a ready fashion. I think the next generation of that is being able to aggregate all that information about yourself from all the places that you touch the system. And then you really have something to work from. Then you really actually know your health history and can then begin to share that and act upon it in the ways that we all want people to be much more empowered and engaged. I can tell you as a doctor, that's absolutely what I want. I want the person to show up with their record and with the information about themselves, with those questions for me, and really leaning into the visit and not having to pull and ask me for the information about themselves.
Right. And it's in a format that can then be aggregated into the system. And I know you've had some experiences in the past where people just don't have access to the information that they need in order to tell their provider, here's my history, here's my medications, et cetera. This makes a huge difference.
Yeah, we had the stark example after Hurricane Katrina, and I remember the day we had a makeshift clinic in New Orleans where we were doing mostly, you know, tetanus shots and sort of mental health supports and some refilling of chronic disease meds like diabetes. And someone had heard that we had a clinic there and sort of walked in and sort of, you know, was, you know, at a time when New Orleans was still partially underwater. So it was very early days after Katrina. And this person was somebody who was HIV positive and was on antiretroviral therapy, but didn't know their medication regimen, which would be common for lots of folks, right? And there wasn't a record of it. And we knew that there was this time-sensitive need to get them back on their regimen, right? Because you don't want their viral load to go up. And then in the subsequent days, people with on TB medication started to arrive because they heard there was healthcare and we didn't have that information. The healthcare system, you know, put this together in Louisiana with a lot of help from the Office of National Coordinator and other folks to use claims data to assemble a record. But yeah, that kind of feeling as a provider, as a doc, I would never want to have again, where you know that you need to get information and there's not a way to get it, and that person really wants the information because they're so empowered that they're, you know, basically going through water to find you, to find a way to get back on their meds.
Well, this podcast that we're doing right now is part of our Women in Health IT series as part of our Steps to Value podcast. Could you address a little bit how the National Coordinator's Office and HHS have supported efforts to increase the participation of women in HIT policymaking?
Well, I think it's an exciting time for women in any of the STEM areas. There's so many more role models for young women, and I think plenty of opportunity for women all throughout their career stages in all kinds of science and technology fields. Health IT is an area where I would like to see many more women at the table, leading at the table. Certainly, when we were considering how to populate our advisory committees, we put thought into diversity of all kinds, including gender diversity. I sought to see that we had leadership that was balanced in perspective in many ways, and I think made a lot of success, frankly, in bringing more people into the tent. That's the language I like to use, that we have a big tent and we bring more people in. I think for a long time, health IT was fairly male-dominated, as many industries can be, but I see a lot of women rising and being more in the forefront. And I'm very excited about that, especially all the energy across the pipeline, right? It's not just senior women who are now increasingly having opportunities to lead, but that there's a pipeline of women who are interested in the field.
How did you first get involved in the government part of all of this? You have an interesting history. Could you share that with us?
I think I'm a user of health IT more than anything. You know, had opportunities all across my career as a doctor and administrator and policymaker to leverage and use IT, health IT in particular, certainly in the post-Hurricane Katrina environment, very active in acquiring and implementing health IT systems in the new healthcare infrastructure we were building. As a public health leader, had opportunity not only to acquire and deploy health IT in our clinical setting, but to start to leverage that data as a way to paint a better picture of our community's health, and was asked to come to ONC to join the family at HHS, largely because of my experiences in applying health information technology to health improvement in the healthcare and public health sphere on the ground, and was delighted to get to do that. I think we learned a lot in Louisiana and had many lessons to apply, and particularly I think was excited at the chance to be a part of the delivery system reform work here at HHS to show how health IT not only can be supported by payment reform, but also how health IT can change care models and make them much more accessible and more patient-centered.
Who was your first mentor?
Probably my mother, certainly, and then a series of teachers along the way.
Any notable pieces of advice that stood out?
My mother was a big advocate for education, and we were poor when I was a kid, and so her advice to me was, get an education, that's your way out of poverty. And it was a great piece of advice for anyone, and I was lucky that I was able to get a good education and that she made that a priority, and she was there to help us with our studies and emphasized, you know, the that we should go to the library and check out books and take advantage of those kind of resources that were available to us to you know, increase our chances at having more opportunity.
Well, in the time since, you know, growing up and going through school and having all these experiences and now in your position, have you had the opportunity to be a mentor?
Well, I certainly have, and one of the longest periods of my career was in academia. I was on the faculty at the Tulane School of Medicine and the Tulane School of Public Health, and in that role did quite a lot of mentorship and teaching, and found it to be one of the most rewarding experiences. Honestly, that's a little bit of the kind of, everyone knows this, that the word physician comes from the word teacher, so often find yourself in a role of supporting, mentoring, teaching others. I think that expression is really true, that you learn so much from the people that you mentor, that it's lovely when it's a bi-directional relationship. I've had some really great mentees across the years.
In that time, how has your, well let's ask this way, how has the environment for women changed since you first started? And what's been the biggest change that you've noticed, and are there any challenges that still remain?
Whew, because I'm old now, so that's a long question.
No.
It's changed a lot. I mean, when I started medical school, I think my class had about 25% women, and now most classes are well over 50%. So it was still, when I started medical school in 1988, there was still a time when there were more men than women in medicine. When I got into leadership in academic medicine, I was the only woman at the table. So in the Department of Medicine, the chair and all the section chiefs were all male, and I was the only woman. And now I disconnected a little bit from exactly the proportions, but over the course of the years that I was in leadership, that changed dramatically, including all the way up to university-level leadership at Tulane. And you can even look at a place like HHS, where I am today, and look at the fact that the secretary is a woman, the deputy secretary is a woman, the assistant secretary for health acting is a woman, the assistant secretary for financial resources for preparedness and response. I could give you a long list, but the senior team here has demonstrated, I think, there's plenty of opportunities at senior level in health generally for women. It's been a big change, I think, just in who's in the room. And the nice part about that is it just adds more diversity of opinion and thought. The more backgrounds people bring and life experience is always, I think, a really good thing. I would just point, since you've asked about mentoring, just kind of to a general issue. I think when I was earlier in my career, when there were fewer women, there was a notion that women needed to have female mentors to seek that out, like find yourself someone who is a successful woman, and that has value. I didn't have women around that were ready mentors, and so I had male mentors in research and in policy work, et cetera, and they were gracious and always gave of their time and support along my career, and I'm thankful for all of them. But I want to raise the point that though it's great to have mentorship, if you're looking for a female mentor, if you're a woman, that's a great thing, but you shouldn't only think that that is the criteria, that the qualification, right? That you should look for people who are engaged in that, not only the kind of work that you want to engage in, but who share your true north. People who have the same goals in mind and the same principles and values, because that's going to help guide the decisions that you make more than even, I think, the content of the work.
How would you describe your true north?
Well, I certainly get up every day trying to sort out how I'm going to make a difference, particularly I'm driven by making a difference in the lives of people who are from low-resource environments. I'll just use the word poverty in particular, because there's many ways you can be low-resource, but having grown up in poverty and knowing that I think for many reasons I was lucky to get out, got help by the system all along the way, whether that was the free lunch program in school or the city recreational department after-school programs or city public transportation. I mean, just a whole host of ways that as a child I was supported and given safe places to play and grow and learn. I'm a big believer in the importance of the supportive infrastructure of communities. And I know that health for many people is something that can get in the way of them going to school, feeling like they can focus on their studies, being able to go to work and provide for their families. And since I am, you know, I know health is my thing. It's a thing I love. I guess I'm always looking for a way that I can keep health from being a barrier to people having the kind of opportunity that they want in life.
Do you ever think that having come from that kind of a background, you have a different perspective on what's important in life? Are you more able to focus in on things and see some of the other distractions as noise?
I don't take for granted that it's going to be hard for some people to do things that we might think are simple. It certainly helped me with doctoring, I can tell you that. It helped me understand when they said that they were late to clinic because the bus was late. I knew exactly what that meant, right? It's not a choice. It's that these things happen, and when you're dependent on public systems like transportation, sometimes life is, you don't have the kind of control. And so then I think it also helps me, Rod, to think about the opportunity that I have, given the bully pulpit and the responsibilities that I have, not only as a physician, but as a policymaker, to give back and try to find a way to help the pathway be easier, not just for individuals, but I think in a systemic fashion, right? So how do we create policy that creates health equity? How do we create policy that creates economic opportunities for everybody?
Karen, do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
All right. We ask most of our guests this, if not all. What's your favorite technological invention, and what do you think its impact has been on culture?
My favorite technological invention would be the flushing toilet, and I'll tell you why. It's not so much exactly the toilet itself, although that's a powerful invention, but it's the idea that we have created water and sewer systems that support the health of people, and that is not only a tremendous advancement for health, but for civilization. It gives us the chance to have healthy communities. And it requires not just the inventor of the toilet, that individual being creative, but it requires an infrastructure of public health and engineering and civic society and elected government. It's just, I think the whole idea of a modern water and sewer system and the toilet being a part of it is one of those great advances that we take for granted in this country, and we shouldn't, because it takes money to invest in that kind of infrastructure, and it's one of the many things that's foundational to good public health.
Well, that's an answer we've never heard before, and I really like it.
You called a public health person.
Dr. Karen DeSalvo is Acting Assistant Secretary for Health and the former National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. Karen, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, Rod. I enjoyed it.
Hi, my name is Barb Cousineau. I bring value to HIMSS organizational affiliates by making sure they get the most out of their OA program benefits. You're listening to Steps to Value.
So, what impact do you think governmental policy has had on the health IT industry? Was meaningful use meaningful? Is Macra the next Macarena? We'd like to hear from you. Send us your thoughts as a voice memo or in an email, and we'll play it or read it on the air at the end of our next episode. You can send your comments to value@hims.org. We'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Karen DeSalvo, Acting Assistant Secretary for Health and the former National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, for sharing her perspective on the impact of government policy on the adoption of health IT. More information on everything discussed by today's guests can be found on this episode's landing page at hims.org/steps to value. Steps to Value is co-produced by Adam Baser. Rhonda Frazier is our story editor and guest relations manager. I'm Rod Pihowski. See you next time on Steps to Value.